Sled Dog Podcast,
Episode 15,
Interview with Joe Runyon. Hi, this is Tim.
And this is Gina, and this is the podcast that makes you want to race, sprint, dash, and even lope on the sport of dog sledding.
Okay, you had me up until lope. What does lope mean?
That is the question. Race, sprint, dash, even lope. If you notice, I did a little something different today.
Yeah, they're not all three of the same, but I have the feeling I know why you've got those. I just don't understand lope.
Why do I have those then?
Well, because the Iditarod's starting, and it's the Iditarod season. Oh, okay. Big miss on my part. What is it?
Well, what do all those four words have in common? They all mean the same thing.
Oh, okay. But what's the it's not because they did a rod?
No,
is it because it's racing season?
No.
Is it because it's sprinting and loping season?
No, it's not. Who are we interviewing today? You're forgetting. You're all about the Iditarod, and you're forgetting that we actually like have an interview today.
That's right. We're interviewing with Joe Runyon today.
Right.
So I still don't get it.
What's his name?
Joe Runyon.
Okay, when you say the last name, say it in syllables really slow.
Run.
Yes,
okay,
these, if you look in your local thesaurus,
yes,
and you look up the word run, you will find the words race, sprint, dash, and even lope.
There
Runyon.
You go. We love you, Joe. Thank you for the interview, but don't let people call you Lopeman, I guess. I know. Hey, well, the fantastic. Joe, what a great guy. We caught up with him up in Clam Gulch,
Alaska.
Alaska at the Clam Gulch Lodge. And he is up there training. And, well, you'll hear more about the interview today, but he is back on the sled this year, folks, for the Iditarod. So we are so excited. It kicks off this weekend, and we are just tickled.
Ready.
Getting on the internet, of course, we're, you know, we live vicariously, 3,000 miles, 4,000 miles away. But we're very, very excited.
Before we start this really interesting interview with Joe, and he explains why he's running in the Iditarod, and I'm not sure if everybody knows that unless they've really been keeping up, but it's really cool. But before we do that, we're going to do some thank yous, and we want to encourage all of you who are in some sort of racing circuit, whether it be a family-type mushing club or even something more professional, to make sure that you are thanking those out there who are volunteering to help us race and help us
Just enjoy the entire sport.
Sure.
I tell you, you know, we in our family, we've got obviously five of us that do different races, so we are just busy throughout the entire race day, and we don't really have an opportunity to volunteer as much as we'd like to. I mean, we try to do it around the edges, but definitely not as much as the timekeepers and the judges and, you know, everybody that's holding sleds
race
and so forth.
Marshal, all those.
It is really amazing how so many people pull together to pull off these local races and some of the larger races to really make sure that everybody has a good time, the races get off. So we wanted to send a special thank you out to Bonnie Ingram and RJ
Williamson.
Thank you, RJ. And just everybody else that has helped us so much at the races, that really puts in so much effort for our mush club here in Michigan. But do I guess yourself not only a favor, but do them a justice by next time you go to a race, or if you're somewhere this weekend or in the next couple weeks where you have a chance to walk up and give them a hug, or just really let them know.
Write
anybody
a thank
that's
you note. You remember that age old thing? Forget the email thing. Or you can do an email for sure, but write a thank you note.
That would be great. Just making sure that they know exactly how much we appreciate them. So not only do we have Joe Runyon, but I'm hoping that everybody takes away from this podcast is the thank you podcast, to really make sure we thank all those out there that not only help us in the sport, but that help contribute to the fun and excitement that we all have.
Yeah, we've had a great racing season. We've got one more race yet this weekend, and the snow is coming down in Michigan. So we're kind of excited about that, and I hope that all of you have had a great race season too. But again, we wouldn't be able to have had that great race season without all the people that have volunteered and chaired races and put the races together, and we just kind of show up and have fun at them. So we're real thankful for that. We also have some mail, Tim.
Yeah, we've got a couple, three or four people that we want to say thank you, and a couple other folks that have thanked us for the podcast. So we've got a couple shouts out. One, two.
Marsha, and she's in Arizona, I believe.
Yeah, I believe it's funny. Flexible.
And she really enjoys the podcast. Her daughter loves listening to the Shoney stories before she goes to bed every night. So that's kind of cool. We've gotten a few of those, Tim.
Yep. And you get the next name because this one's a hard one for me.
Well, I didn't do the last name, but Ursula from Poland. Let us know that she found us. She's a teacher in Poland and wanted us to do a couple things for her. We haven't been able to make that happen yet, but we will.
Which is wonderful. And then, of course, our local, we have a friend here locally that I like to compete to. So, Chad, if you're out there, we want to say thank you so much for the feedback. Chad Keller from Traverse City, Michigan. And he liked the Frank Turner interview.
And we have had lots of kids for the Shoney stories. We're going to do a separate Shoney special thing at one point, but we're really happy that a lot of kids have been enjoying the Shoney stories, listening to them over and over at night, and the next one is coming up.
Yeah, should be out tonight or tomorrow. So
part two of the Iditarod.
Exactly. So big season for us. Again, remember to thank everybody out there. Everybody that's gone out to our website and clicked on the Amazon link, we thank you so much. You know, it's about paying for the bandwidth now, so which is good, meaning the hosting fees for putting up the podcast. But please do, if you get a chance, and you happen to want to buy a book or buy something from Amazon, there's a lot of fantastic things out there. If you go through our page first, there's a link on the right-hand side that you can just click on the Amazon box and then go do your surfing on Amazon. What that does is it just gives us a little bit of, I guess it's a commission, but it's a little bit of percentage. It doesn't cost you guys anything more. It just simply gives us a percentage off of Amazon's fee. So it's kind of a great little service that that they've provided for us, and it obviously drives traffic to their site, and it's a win-win for anybody that happens to want to buy something from Amazon. So let us know if it works out, and if you have a problem at all, give us a holler. But it's been we've had quite a few people buying things, from cameras to books to all kinds of things. So we thank you so much for doing that. And also, we're still looking for a sponsor. So we're going to ramp up the season after probably the Iditarod season, or I guess probably next week, now that we're done racing for ourselves this year. We'll probably ramp up the season and start the interviews much more often than we are. So if anybody needs a product that they'd like us to mention on the air, please let us know.
Oh, don't forget, Tim, we have a Dr. Tim tip on stress diarrhea.
Yes, very exciting. Actually, it was very timely for us because Dr. Tim shared with us some ideas, because we got into our first couple of races and we had a couple of puppies that, had stress diarrhea.
Yeah, so we have one really, really hyper puppy, and this is her first year racing. Her name is Sheba, and we believe she'll be a lead someday, but she still gets a little bit freaked out. And good enough, soon as she's done with a race or on the trail with me on the five dog, sometimes she'll have stress diarrhea. And so we had to help her out with that so she could race and run well. She loves to race, so we didn't want it to hinder her. So make sure you listen to that. It's good.
Yeah, it's
good
great stuff. So let's jump into the interview, and then don't forget, we're going to come right back with a Dr. Tim tip right after the Joe Runyon interview. Here we go. Well, hey, Joe, thanks for joining us today. Joe, I know our listeners would love to know your story a little bit. Could you tell us, how did you get started in dog sledding?
Good question. One of those accidental events. I came to Alaska in 1970. I was fighting forest fires just after I got out of college, and one of my job assignments was fighting some fires in the interior of Alaska along the Yukon River. And that's where I first saw some sled dogs. Was naturally intrigued, a little fascinated, and I met some native guys, some Indian guys in a village named Tanana, and they said, well, why don't you come back in the fall time and go moose hunting? So after fire season, I took a kayak from Nanana, about 250 miles down the Tanana River to the confluence of the Yukon, and landed in Tanana and went moose hunting. And one of the guys who became a really good friend of mine, a long lifetime friend, Freddie Jordan, said, let's go trapping. So he had some sled dogs. I got some more sled dogs around the village, and we went out trapping all winter, and that's what was my introduction.
Now, how old were you at the time?
I guess I was 21, 22.
Oh, fantastic. And where were you living at the time?
Well, I had been living in Corvallis, Oregon. I went to school at Oregon State. So as soon as I got out of college, I went up to Alaska.
Wow, that is fantastic. So after you spent that first winter, did you just decide to move on up and hang out?
No, I was one of those people that just kind of disappeared off the face of the earth. You know, that was that period of time where it seemed like a lot of people. I guess maybe there was just a few people that were going back to the bush in Alaska. I mean, you know, I knew a lot of people that lived along the Yukon. There was probably a dozen people, maybe a couple dozen, that just lived out and trapped out all winter. So that's what I did, you know. A lot of the winter I was just out on trap lines or traveling with my dogs, and I just did that more or less for 10 years.
Wow. So you began running dogs just to help you to trap. Did you make a decent living doing trapping, or how does that work?
Yeah, you know, trapping's kind of like unemployment, and then usually people that lived in the bush, they'd commercial fish in the summer, which is what I did. I commercial salmon fish, and that's where you make most of your money, and then trapping's kind of like unemployment. But, you know, it's one of those deals where you just kind of define the rules of how you want to live. You know, like some people were really radical. They said, well, I don't want to have any snow machines. I don't want to go motorized at all. Other people like me kind of make a compromise and say, well, I just want to use dogs in the winter, but I'm willing to use a outboard motor and a chainsaw. So that was my compromise. But in the winter, I just preferred the dogs. I never thought about using snow machines or anything. So it was just an adventure, kind of a lifestyle thing, and had a lot of good friends and spent time out in the woods. And then in the spring, set up another camp, spring camp. At that time in the 70s, it was maybe not legal, but it was tolerated. You could go to a spring camp and shoot geese and trap and fish and everything with, you know, very little supervision. So, you know, you were just living a subsistence lifestyle. So it was a lot of fun, good memory of that time.
That is super neat. I guess that's probably a dream of a lot of people. So what made the change then? All of a sudden the Iditarod starts up, and how did you get involved with that?
Well, I remember listening to reports of the Iditarod in 73. That was the first year that the Iditarod went all the way to Nome. And, the buzz got around. It was definitely an adventure that kind of caught your attention. Then I met a few people that had done it, and the idea just kind of incubated in the back of my mind. But the problem was it was pretty expensive. You know, if you're living out in the bush, you don't have a vehicle, you're away from the road system, you got to go 200 miles to get to the highway. So it kind of just incubated in my mind. But then I got settled down and married, had some kids, and I thought, well, you know, now is the time to maybe think about it. So in 83, I ran my first Iditarod. But I'd been around sled dogs for, you know, a long time and used them. I mean, really used them for trapping and freighting, and so I had a good background, you know, traveling with dogs and living with them. So it was a pretty easy transition. I just had to get a little different kind of dog in order to try to be competitive.
So how did you get to that point of actually getting to civilization and actually getting a truck and being able to actually get there? Did you actually move before then?
Well, I was living in Tanana in 1985. That's the year I won the Yukon Quest. And the first year I ran the Iditarod in 1983, we were still living out pretty much commercial fishing on the Yukon. But in 85, after I won the Yukon Quest, I made the decision to move to Nenana, which is on the Parks Highway, just a little south of Fairbanks. And that way I could get my kids in a different school. So that's kind of when I made the transition and really made a commercial operation out of the kennel, was in 85.
Well, that's fantastic. Okay, so you did the quest in 85, was the big first race you won. What happened after that? Was your goal always the Iditarod, or did you like the smaller races? I know you won in 89, but what kind of led up to that?
Well, the Iditarod was kind of always the one you wanted to win. Our kennel did really well in the 200 and 300 mile races, you know, where you need maybe a little more speed. So it took me a while to figure out the Iditarod, but from the very start, I kind of knew how I had to do it. At that time, Butcher and Swenson were the two dominating mushers. They weren't necessarily winning every year, but they were the ones that had the best shot at it. So I kind of figured in the summertime, I had to raise as many pups as they did, or maybe even more than they did, and be really selective about what kind of dogs I was running in my team. And I figured that's the best way to do it. You have to get a big core right away. You can't sit there and have sled dogs for 20 years and think you're going to raise 4 or 5 dogs a year and get a great team. You got to raise a lot of pup, get a nice core of dogs, and then build on it. And my game plan was, there was kind of a window, 3 years to 7 years. That's when you got the best, most mature animals. So I figured in 7 years I'd be able to beat them. And that's what happened in a way.
So let's just jump back real quick. So looking back at your high school years, and then looking back at this period around 85 to 89, I mean, was it anything that you'd ever thought you'd be like?
No, it's a completely unusual one. Although when I was a kid, I always had bird dogs, and my dad had bird dogs. So you know, the idea of using dogs for work, that wasn't a strange concept. And I do remember distinctly reading a book, which I'd like to figure out what one it was, but there was a lot of stories about trappers in Canada and Yukon, in the Yukon, and I really remember that. I just can't remember what the book was, but that influenced me. And then when I moved to Alaska, I saw the sled dogs, and I thought, well, you know, that's something I ought to look at. So, yeah, it definitely caught my attention.
Now, you ran the circuit for probably, I mean, I guess, what, 10 or 12 years almost?
Yeah, 10 years. That was my little entry into dog racing. And then in 93, I woke up one morning and I just said, let's do something different. So we organized things, and in a period of about 2 weeks, I had 200 dogs sold. And then I was out of the dog business.
Wow, where'd you go?
Yeah, that was it. That was an unusual kind of existential period. So we packed up and moved to the lower 48 and just kind of sampled areas, lived in Idaho for a while, lived in Colorado, and then eventually ended up down in New Mexico. I even had a fish farm down in Mexico for a while. So I kind of went through a period there of just reinventing myself and got away from the sled dogs and started fooling around with bird dogs and horses and mules, that sort of thing. So, yeah, that was a big transition because I had... My kennel was about 200-300 dogs, you know, for 10 years. So all of a sudden, you don't have 200-300 dogs to wake up to every morning. That was a big change.
Yeah, much quieter. You probably got some sleep.
Yeah, well, you know, when you had it organized, it wasn't too bad because everything was a cycle, you know. You get up in the morning, hopefully you have everything done by 5 or 6. And yeah, I had it. It was just a, kind of a nice cycle. But I really missed it. But on the other hand, I kind of thought I'd played it out as far as I could. And so it was a good change.
So for you, once you won the Iditarod once after that, did you not envision yourself winning more than once, or how did that work?
Well, I made the decision. I really had, including living as kind of out in the bush subsistence, I'd had dogs for over 20 years. So just got to this stage where I thought, well, I wanted to try something different. I really enjoyed it, but I just couldn't see myself doing it for the rest of my life. So made the big change. But I find myself this year running a team of sled dogs with Rachel Sidoris and the Iditarod. So here it is, 15 years after I won it, I'm back again just hoping I can finish it.
Well, and we're going to get to that. And that's the greatest thing about it, Joe, because you are one of the, I don't know, I don't want to boost your ego too much here, but I love listening to you when you're talking and doing announcing and kind of commentary on the sport. You didn't go far from the sport. You've always been involved with it from the commentary side of it, at least for the last 10, 15 years. Tell us about that time. Obviously, you're a sought-out resource, but you also are a great communicator that can share your ideas with people. Why did you stay so much into it? You still love the sport, obviously, but what drew you back each year?
Good question. Yeah, I thought I had a lot of experience or a little bit of insight, and I got sucked back into the vortex through the media, noticed I really enjoyed it, and kind of developed a new rapport with a lot of the mushers and just tried to interpret the event for the public. So that's how I got wrapped up in it, and did some consultation for different film entities, like a Japanese crew did a documentary, and worked with a German film crew, worked with Outdoor Life Network, which is now Versus, and then the Iditarod Media Group. And then in a kind of a strange twist, I did some consulting for Discovery Channel because they had decided to do a documentary on Rachel Sidoris. And as it turned out, the musher that Rachel usually travels with, Timmy Osmar, severely broke his leg last summer. And they thought it could heal up, but then by Christmas this year, Discovery and Rachel and Timmy said, well, we got to make a different game plan. We're going to have to put a different musher on the sled. And that's all of a sudden where I came in. They asked me if I'd do it, and on January 11th, it was a go, and we said, okay, let's do it. And I flew up to Clam Gulch, Alaska, and started training with Rachel.
Okay, so now how long has it been since you were on a sled?
Well, for a real sled ride, it's been 16 years.
That is fantastic. And so when they came to you and asked you, and they said, Joe, we'd like you to do that, what were the first thoughts that went through your head?
Well, it was such a novel offer. I molded over. I didn't make a decision for a couple of days, but I called up some good friends of mine, John Baker and Bruce Lee, called my daughters, and they all agreed, oh, you can't pass this one up. You better jump on it and just do it. So a couple of days later, I said, yeah, I'll do it.
Okay, so I want to know the truth, though. Thinking of getting on a sled with 16 highly powered Iditarod dogs, was there any butterflies going on in your stomach?
Yeah, a little bit. You know, I had to think about it. You know, and I thought about I was getting older, too. That was another thing, because I'm 59. And then, I just kind of thought about it. There'd been a lot of guys older than me do it. And it was just one of those lucky deals. I'd been working out pretty hard during the summer, so I thought I was ready to do it. I just told Rachel, yeah, let's do it. I've known Rachel since she was a little baby, so I'm sympathetic, empathetic, and really want to travel with her. It'll be a lot of fun.
Well, and that, I think that's absolutely fantastic. And, you know, to think that you're going to be able to do this again is wonderful. And I don't think you're that old, Joe. I think some of the people are getting into it at your age, so I think you've got a pretty good leap on them. But also, with that in mind, you're going to be the visual interpreter for her. You weren't able to register before the time frame. Are they going to just let you take over Tim's spot?
Yeah, that's the way it worked out. Timmy asked for a medical exemption, which the Iditarod honored. I mean, he just can't do it. He broke his leg so severely last summer, and it hasn't healed up well. So he bowed out. They allowed me to be his alternate musher. And then we had to work out the details. I think it's pretty well a done deal, but we had to work out the details of how the race was going to accommodate Rachel.
Right.
Because she definitely needs a visual sight guide on the trail. I mean, some things she can see, like forms or points of light or something like that. But, you know, she'll be the first to tell you, like, if there's a fork in the trail, especially on a bright sunny day on white tundra, or even on a dull evening day when her eyesight is the best, she can't see it. No way. So there has to be some kind of accommodation. What the Iditarod finally decided to do is let Rachel and I start last with no time penalty, which I think is a fair deal. I mean, I would have really argued if they would have penalized on a time penalty, I would have really screamed and hollered. So the accommodation's pretty good.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I mean, I know that the Discovery Channel is going to help you guys out. Are you guys taking film equipment and running it on the sleds and so forth also?
Well, that's another thing that was debated in the negotiations with the Iditarod Trail Committee. The Discovery Channel got to go ahead to do the production, but the catch is they can't in any way interfere with the progress of the race. So they'll be flying along, they'll have a snow machine on the trail, and then Rachel and I will have these specially designed head cameras.
Okay.
And that'll record a lot of the action that we see on the trail. Then they'll have, from time to time, a helicopter, and then they'll get a lot of the images from the Iditarod media group. So it's a full-blown production, but I don't think it'll interrupt our progress up the trail at all.
No, I just want to know if you're going to have a chance to edit for those times that you're falling. No, I'm just kidding. No worries.
Yeah, I don't think there's any punches pulled. I imagine that's what they're looking for. They're hoping we create a little excitement. But Rachel and I are looking at an uneventful trip over the Alaska Range. That's where we have the most anxiety. But this year it looks like there's good snow, and so those cruxes like the Happy Valley Steps and the Dalzell Gorge, if with a little luck, I think we'll get through them.
And so that was kind of my next question. Since you haven't been out there in a few years, what's the thing you're most excited about, and what's the thing you're most anxious about?
Well, the thing I'm most anxious about is it just managing the team intelligently. I mean, one thing I've really seen traveling on the trail, I haven't missed an Iditarod since 93 as a commentator or member of some media group. So, you know, I probably had the best seat in the house for following the race. And the last 3 years I've been in a helicopter following the leaders. So I could probably claim that as a spectator, I've had the best seat in the house for the last 3 years for sure. And the one thing I've noticed is how judgment falls on the part of a lot of mushers when they start the Iditarod. You have to be really conservative to hold together a team. I mean, you just can't get too wild about your race. So I'm going to try to learn from that observation. The first 2 days as we go over the Alaska Range, I'm going to try to run a really conservative game plan.
Great. Okay. And what are you excited about?
Well, what I'm excited about, I want to get 16 dogs to midway. See, if we can get 16 dogs, 15 dogs midway, say like at the milepost 400, 450, right around Takotna, that kind of power will translate into speed. So that's our goal, get a big team up the trail at least halfway. And then if we have any chance of having some fun and maybe beating some people, we'll start to think about it then.
That is awesome. Now, you know, in the commentary side, you had a tendency to look at the bigger picture, ask people some pretty deep questions along the trail and find out what's going on and so forth. Are you going to be able to back that off, do you think, to run the race?
Well, I was hoping, you know, I'm going to be out of, likely we're going to be out of the mix as far as following the front of the pack. Like, I really want to see what Lance and Mackie and Paul Gebhardt do this year, because they're the guys that have a lot of experience with kind of a new way of running the race. So I want to see what the counter moves are by the other mushers. So I'm going to miss out on that. I'm going to find out when I get to know them, I'll be able to talk to them. But that's what really interests me. It seems like to me the personality of the race this year is everybody sat back and they said, Mackie and Gebhardt won the race with dog teams that trot. And the way they did it is they were really conservative and really cautious in the first half of the race. In fact, they gave away 6 hours, you know, in the first half of the race last year. But they made it up. And so even though maybe you're not the fastest team on the trail, you can be the winner. And a lot of people are rolling that over in their mind. So that's the kind of the mindset I see coming into this year's race, and I want to see how it plays out.
That's wonderful. And you don't think that they'll just wait for you guys to catch up so you guys can hang out with them?
Yeah, I think they're going to be waving goodbye to us. There won't even be vapor on the trail by the time I get there, but well, I'll hear about it and have fun talking to him when we get to know him.
Well, that's awesome. Now, as far as, I guess, the bigger picture, do you think this is a start of you getting back into this at all? Or do you think this will be a one time only?
Yeah, I think this is going to be Joe's final Iditarod. But it's going to be a good one, and it's been great working with Rachel. I should comment on her. She's 22 and really accomplished. I mean, she's lived around sled dogs all her life. This is something she really wants to do. But the one thing I've learned from her, because she just had to overcome so many challenges with her limited sight, that I just love being around her. Everything is kind of positive negativism. Like for example, she'll say, we'll go down a hill and maybe she'll crash and burn. She'll say, I had a bad wreck, but the lucky thing was I couldn't see it. You know, I mean, she interprets all the events and turns them around, just has fun with them. So, been great. Really inspirational to work with.
That's great. And can you tell us how you knew her as a baby?
Well, I knew her dad before she was born. He was associated with a dog food company that I did some protocols on some premium feeds. And so we kind of knew each other. He was down in Oregon. I was up in Alaska. And he had sled dogs. Jerry had sled dogs. And then Rachel was born, and it just happened that my family and I were traveling in Oregon. We stopped by, said hello, saw the little baby, and then I learned about a year later that they discovered that she had some very severe vision problems, and they were trying to figure it out, trying to see if there was a way to solve it. And then from then I knew that, you know, Jerry had his work cut out trying to raise Rachel and get her through life, you know, trying to deal with her vision difficulties.
What a wonderful story. And, you know, I got to commend, you know, being a daddy and you being a daddy, you know, with daughters, it's something that, you know, you never want to have to go through, but you really got to appreciate how Jerry took that on and, you know, made something out of it and let his daughter fulfill her dreams and was there to support her. Is he up there training with you guys?
Yeah. We're all together. Yeah. Rachel hooks up 16 dogs, and usually the procedure is I'll take off first, and then she'll pull the hook, and she'll travel right behind me. And then if we have a long section of good trail, the trail that we're pretty confident about, we'll practice, she'll pass, and then I'll travel behind her for 4 or 5 miles. And then if we think it's going to get dicey again, she'll stop, I'll go around her and kind of lead the way. Usually, like if we're going down some real steep, dicey stuff, I'll try to ball my dogs up so her dogs are right next to mine, but sometimes that doesn't work out. She has to ride it down herself, and she's a really good sled rider, really athletic, and usually makes it in good shape. But the big problem with Rachel is, I mean, it's just like me trying to read the numbers on my cell phone, you know. I can't do it. But she can definitely not see a fork in the trail, and she has a real tough time, especially when the sun is shining. There's no way she can differentiate what direction we have to go. So she needs somebody there to tell her those things. But as far as taking care of her dogs and hustling and getting up hills, that sort of thing, she does everything herself.
So from feeding to, you know, hooking them up, everything, that's all her.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, that was one of the questions that the Iditarod had when they sanctioned her to go on the race, was can you take care of the dogs yourself? And yeah, most certainly she's proved that she can.
That's wonderful.
You know, there's some things you have to think about, like if you're in a parking lot and you've been in the grocery store. So you go in the grocery store and Rachel will want to get something, so she'll ask the clerk or something where it is, they'll take her back there. So you'll say, well, okay, we're going to meet right here before we go back out in the parking lot. So you'll meet her, but after a while you don't even think about it. You know that's what you got to do. Or if you're in a vehicle and she just comes out of a store, you honk the horn and she'll locate, and so you get over there. Well, it's the same thing in a checkpoint or when we're out training. You know, you just, after a while, you get used to it. You just say, hey, Rachel, you give her a heads up where you're at. So she figures it out and gets everything done. It's great.
That's awesome. And now, normally, communications is not, you know, used on the trail, but you guys are going to be able to wear, what, like walkie-talkie headset type things?
Yeah, but that hadn't worked out too well. It's a good idea, but it just doesn't work out. It's better if we just travel together and then I'll holler back at her. You know, like if there's a tree that fell over or something that conked you on the head, I'll say, hey, Rachel, get behind your sled. There's some low branches. Watch out for your eyes, that sort of thing. So it's great, though. After a while, it's just kind of second nature, and you just kind of remember you got to mention it, you know. So if she gets a little behind and has to stop and straighten her dogs out or something like that, then I'll stop and wait for her. But after a while, after 20 training runs, it's all second nature now.
Well, that's great. Well, I know you've got some writing behind you, so do I smell a definite story coming on after this race?
Oh, it might be. I know you're going to really enjoy this documentary that Discovery's making. It's more than just a story about Rachel and her challenge of running the Iditarod. It's also going to be a story about sled dogs in Alaska and just the adventure of traveling with sled dogs. So that's going to be the big project, and that film will probably premiere next fall. So there's going to be a lot of work putting all the footage together and scripting this thing out.
Well, I can imagine that it might inspire some 21-year-olds to go move up to Alaska, you know, just like it did with you. So I think that's wonderful.
Yeah, it'll be a different kind of film. It's not really a sports story. It's more an adventure story. It'll be a lot of fun. The guy that's doing it and has joined with Rachel, his name is Vikram Jayanti, and he did the Muhammad Ali George Foreman fight in Africa when we were kings. So he's used to those kind of stories, and he's really enjoying this whole adventure of sled dogs. We got a lot of good footage already.
Yeah, I was going to say, is he up there, and is it how is the weather up there while he's up there?
Well, he's not here at the moment. As soon as we get to Anchorage, the crew will be back again, although we've done some stuff in training, but the real story is going to be the race itself, so we're going to join back up with the Discovery crew in Anchorage next week.
That's wonderful. And now Tim's dogs, he's obviously, or you and others have trained his dogs up, and Rachel's dogs, are they looking pretty good this year?
Yeah. Both teams are traveling at about the same speed. We'll hope that they do that, you know, throughout the race. It all depends on how the luck goes, you know, if we both have the same number of dogs and that sort of thing, see how things go, but yeah, Timmy's dogs are great, and a lot of seasoned veterans. And then Rachel's got an improved team. Definitely her team's a better team than she had in 2006 when she finished the Iditarod.
Well, that's fantastic. And is there any, I guess when you guys sat down and you're looking over and your nighttime conversations around the fireplace and so forth, are you going to try to stick to a schedule, that conservative schedule you're talking about, or are you going to kind of play it out based on what the other mushers are doing?
No, I think we got it pretty well figured out. And actually, I got a lot of good advice from Doug Swingley. We talked it over, and I agree with Doug. It just kind of just crystallized everything. But what we're going to try to do, we're going to try to run early morning, evening time, basically because that's the time that's easiest on Rachel's eyes. If she's out there in the middle of the day with bright sun, it just gives her a headache. You know, she's just got to wear dark glasses. So we're going to try to organize it kind of like a schedule at home. We're going to run in the morning, rest in the afternoon, say like from 11 to 4 or 5. Then we're going to run through the late evening and into the dark and hopefully be at a checkpoint or a camp by 10 at night. And then we're going to take our big break at night, hopefully about an 8-hour rest, maybe from, say, 10 till 6 in the morning, and then we'll crank up again. So pretty conservative, but I think it'll get us, down the trail at a pretty steady pace.
Well, how many days do you think it'll take based on that schedule and how many miles you probably can do and so forth it'll be?
I think Rachel would like to do an 11-day. I'm being conservative and saying a 12-day race, but if things look good and we have a lot of power, I think we can be in the 11-day.
That's wonderful. And are your family members going to come be there with you?
Yeah, we'll see what happens as the race develops. Maybe a few of my daughters might make it up and watch the finish in Nome. We'll see how it goes.
That's wonderful. Now, have they ever been in this sport at all? And, you know, I've got daughters, and a lot of our listeners are family-oriented mushers and so forth. How do they feel about Daddy's adventures? And how old were they when you stopped mushing and so forth? Are they looking forward to getting back into it or seeing it?
Well, they're real supportive. The two youngest daughters work for Mitt Seavey and for Jeff King at their sled dog concessions in the summer. So they know all about sled dogs, but they were too little when I was doing it. And then the next oldest daughter, she definitely had sled dogs, and she enjoyed it. Now, whether she's going to get back into it again, I don't know, but she was enthused. Then the oldest son was a good dog man, too, but he's on track on another career. So whether any of them will actually drive sled dogs again or not, I don't know, but they're all supportive and thought it was a good idea.
Well, that is wonderful. You know, and we've asked you a lot of stuff about running dogs. We've asked you about a little bit about your children, about what your past has been and so forth. But tell us, what is the passion in your life outside of dog sledding and I guess anything else? What do you love to do when you've got the time to do it?
Well, I always enjoyed the sled dogs. I always like animals. Now I have mules and bird dogs. So I spend a lot of time riding, like horses. That's kind of my new hobby. A lot of packing back into the wilderness areas up in the national parks. And then I've always been a big bird hunting fan. I've always had bird dogs of some kind, but now I have English pointers. Really enjoy them.
And do you miss the cold weather?
Well, the cold weather, now that's another question. I'm not so sure I ever really enjoyed it, but I'm definitely prepared for it. Got a lot of good gear, and I'm definitely thinking if it gets 40, 45 below, we got to be ready for it. So that's been a big part of our strategy. Make sure we have good gear.
Well, especially if you can make it to checkpoints, but if you can't, obviously being ready for that, that's a good point.
It's just interesting that you chose to settle down in New Mexico. I mean, can't get much more south.
Yeah, that was a strange change. Well, you never can tell, you know. Sometimes you just have to make a big change, you know, try some pivot points in your life. So, yeah, I'm down in New Mexico. It's definitely a lot warmer, but I'm really enjoying being back up here in Alaska, too. A lot of good friends here.
Oh, absolutely. And is there anything, I guess, you know, from the recommendation side, you've written a book, multiple articles, you've been commentating for years. Any advice that you would give to the newer mushers or the folks that are getting into this, maybe a couple of years into it, well, even like ourselves, you know, just give us some advice that you would say to the mushing folks out there that are getting into it.
Well, you know, one interesting aspect of dog mushing is it's kind of one of those solitary hobbies, solitary preoccupations. But I'd always recommend that people get a good second opinion. Like if my observation, for example, on the Iditarod, you know, I find myself all the time watching certain mushers, and I'll be making predictions about what they're going to do, what their behavior will be. And I'll catch myself, and I go, wow, you know, I could make that kind of statement about somebody. I wonder what I could make about myself and not know it, you know. But, for example, in the racing, every year there's the team has a different personality, but the musher keeps the same way of looking at things. Like there's some mushers that like to go fast. They're always committed to a fast strategy, maybe fast, quick runs and long rests, say in the distance game. And there's other ones that say, no, I'd rather just let them trot nice and easy. I'll go a little longer, maybe rest a little less, but I think that's physiologically more efficient. But in some ways, I think people would benefit from a coach that would say, well, let's look at the personality of your dog yard this year, and let's figure out how you should handle them. So, you know, I think probably you got to learn to be flexible, learn to be experimental.
That's wonderful. And I think that's probably the message, obviously, for us in the sprint world, because we're getting a lot of dogs from all over the place. And obviously, each dog you put in the mix changes everything. And So it really is a good advice to stay flexible.
Yeah, I had such a flexible day today that I didn't go very fast on my training run because I decided to be flexible and put a yearling in lead. And she was not very happy about that.
But you learn quickly. Well, Joe, this has been fantastic. Is there anything else that you'd like to tell everybody that's listening?
Well, just keep track of Rachel and I on the trail. I really appreciate it. I think you'll be surprised. Rachel will hopefully do it again, get herself to Nome. Watch out for that film next fall by Discovery. And then I should mention another project. Had some fun working with Jeff King on his new book.
Oh.
Cold Hands, Warm Heart. So if you get a chance to read the book, I've been getting a lot of nice comments from readers, and it's a heck of a story. Jeff is a really great storyteller.
So you actually did the writing, or how did that work?
No, I just helped Jeff transcribe a lot of stuff that he had recorded and just kind of helped organize. But it was a big effort. His wife, Donna, contributed a lot of organizing effort and artwork, and it was quite a crew, but we started the book in the summer and got it out here in time for Iditarod. So that's a big turnaround for a book, 7 months from start to finish. But these are all stories that Jeff organized and then delivered verbally, orally, in front of big groups of tourists. And then a lot of them were transcribed, and he edited them and put it together and had some people help him organize it and came up with a book in 7 months. So I thought that was a great accomplishment. I think the readers will enjoy it.
That's absolutely huge. That is wonderful. And thank you so much for your articles in Mushing Magazine and other places. We love them. So I hope you can continue those going, too.
Well, I appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Hey, well, thank you so much. And I don't want to say good luck because I don't think you're going to need it. Just be blessed and have a great time on the trail.
Okay. Talk to you guys later.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Oh, fantastic interview, huh, dear?
Yeah, that was great. I loved it because you might have thought that we knew that he was running with Rachel Sidoris, but we didn't.
No.
So we've been actually trying to contact Joe Runyon for, in all winter, really. But he's a hard guy to track down. And finally, we found him, and we found him in Clam Gulch, Alaska. And he was really happy to interview. It was just really hard getting a hold of him. We had no idea that he was running the Iditarod.
Right.
We don't read the Alaska newspapers normally, and though a couple of the stories were in there. So it was cool. We were just really calling to interview Joe, and we got the second scoop about it, and that was really cool. And eventually we will interview Rachel as well, but it was neat to kind of combine the both.
Yeah, you know, and there's something about Joe that I really appreciated kind of in the background. It was, you know, I got to tell you, it was a harder interview because Joe did not want to talk about himself.
No.
And I, you know, that is such a humbling, but yet you can tell Joe has spent his life commentating on the race and on the different aspects of the mushers and so forth that he is so used to giving credit and throwing ideas and perspective about other people and doesn't really want to talk about himself that much. And I thought that was really interesting. It wasn't that he was shy per se. I just think that he really enjoys giving a lot of credit and really being proud of other people, what they're doing. So it was very interesting. So Joe, thank you so much for the interview. Very interesting. I don't know what it would be like to really get back on a sled after that many years. Of course, it's, I don't know. I guess it's all that knowledge that he had. You're not going to lose that knowledge, but maybe the coordination and the motivation.
Well, we had lots of questions that didn't get answered or didn't have time to answer, but I want to know what the difference is between the dogs 16 years ago and the dogs that he's running now, which is why I asked the one question. Okay, kid on the back of the sled was 16 highly powered Iditarod dogs. They're a different breed of dog.
Yeah,
I mean, it's
true.
Changed. Yeah. So, I mean, it's not even that, I can get on a sled and ride it, but who's in front of you?
That's right.
You know, I wouldn't just jump on a sled with a bunch of Iditarod dogs and think I knew what I was doing.
Well, and the good news is that he has, because he's been following the trail so much, and, you know, it's not like it was a snapshot of, okay, last time I even saw dogs was 16 years ago. I mean, I guess mentally he's been prepared for
Absolutely.
This probably.
And
but as far as just the thrust and the torque that they could provide for the sled, that'd probably be quite a bit different.
the interesting thing is he was working out all summer, kind of physically getting himself in shape, and he did not know he was doing this.
Right, no.
He didn't know until December. Yep. So it's kind of interesting how God kind of prepares you sometimes for some big things. And so we'll be praying for him.
Yeah, and we're going to pray for Tim Osmore to make sure his leg gets healed up really solid and wonderfully. I guess solid. Hopefully it's the part of the leg should be solid and it's not his ankle or something. Anyways, okay, I'll stop. Anyways, but the best part about it is that he was able to help out. And also, I think the end result could be a wonderful opportunity for all the mushers and the whole world to see what the Iditarod is really like through the Discovery Channel interview. Or, I don't know, what is, a special, I guess it is.
Right.
So it should be pretty exciting. So, hey, now we've got a tip from Dr. Tim Hunt from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. He has a clinic there and also has Pursuit Dog Food. You can get to him at drtims.com. That's drtims.com. And Dr. Tim just kind of provides us with little insights, 5-minute little vet tips to kind of keep us on track and give us some ideas to think about in the different seasons. And this one coming up is on stress diarrhea. Pretty exciting. Here we go. Hey, Dr. Tim, tell us a little bit about these dogs when they run really hard.
Sure. One of the calls I'll get a lot, and I'll see in races for that matter, is something that we call stress diarrhea. And what that means is we've got a dog that's really working hard, and there might be some stool still in its colon. There might be some other reasons, too, that can factor in there. But we'll start to see some blood along around the rectum where they might actually defecate some blood, and that's what we call stress diarrhea. And there's a lot of ideas as to why this happens and the things that we can try to do to alleviate it. And number one, if we have a dog that incurs this and they don't have a fever and they're acting fine, they're not going to die from this. This is just something because of a hardworking dog and the food in its GI tract, more typically than not. If we have a dog that has this kind of bloody stool during a run and he has a fever and he goes off his food, that's a whole different story that we're really not going to talk about now. But with these hardworking dogs, be it in an Iditarod team or a sprint team, we'll see the same type of occurrence, and it freaks people out. I'll run into it in my dogs, too, when they're really working hard. And one of the best things to use to try to alleviate this is the use of psyllium or Metamucil. So with these dogs where we're encountering a lot, I tend to use maybe 1 to 2 teaspoons per feeding of Metamucil or psyllium, same thing, in their food, and they eat that, and that'll really help take care of the problem. That's kind of a laxative type medicine, but it really softens the stool and it tends to let the colon rest. A couple other ideas out there are to adjust your feeding schedule so we're feeding at least 4 hours away from when we're going to do the activity. That can help some of these dogs out. Some people will use a product called Blue Heron, which is a psyllium natural herb type additive. And again, that works pretty nicely with those guys, but we have to use it with their food or when we feed them. And that helps to try to prevent this. But don't panic when we see this with dogs. It could make us start to think about different issues that are arising in the kennel, be it parasites, might be a consideration if a lot of dogs have it, the type of food that we are feeding. There are a lot of efforts by some of the top foods out there to try to adjust their formulations to help prevent this or help to treat that. And I think diets have come a long, long ways in the last 5 years with trying to manage the stress issues, but we'll still run into it even on the best foods. So when we run into those few odd dogs, even on the best foods, that's when we use the psyllium in addition to maybe the psyllium that's in the food. We might consider the use of adding some rice to the diet too, or the use of meat for that matter. But it's one of those things where I would consider consulting with an experienced musher, experienced race vet, when you run into it for different ideas as to why this is occurring. But it is fixable. It isn't something where I would pull the dog out of the team or ditch him from the race plans. It just means we have to take a little extra effort with that one dog or two dogs to get him through this. And again, they don't expire from it. It's just one of those things that we encounter when the dogs are working hard that maybe we could do a better job in trying to fix. But I really start to get some calls on the phone in December when dogs are start to really put the miles on or we're really pushing it to the dogs. And then they get through it and they get better. So don't be panicked when you run into that kind of thing. But there's a lot of different ideas out there, and those are just a few to kind of get your mind working and the ball rolling. And if you have more questions, again, talk to an experienced musher or race vet and see if we can figure something else out too.
Okay, so if we really went, you know, into the grocery store and bought Metamucil, that would work? Or would it be better to go to the pet store and find psyllium?
No, Metamucil is psyllium. Same thing, just a trade name. I just get unflavored Metamucil. Okay. But you can buy different generic formulations of it too.
Okay.
Is there any lifestyle change that we should put them in a pen versus a chain or
anything like that? No, I think it's the individual dog, especially see it with young dogs. hardworking males, things like that. And then dietary relations can really play into this too. You know, the type of food we're feeding. Look at the food you're feeding.
Right. This might be just a little bit off, but we had this situation, and before we did a long run, we actually put a little broth, meat broth, in their water. And of course, all the dogs drank it right up. We went on a run, and after the run, everybody had diarrhea.
Yeah, that's more of a relation of volume, I think, than anything else. Unless the meat broth was completely novel to them that they've never seen before. So if you load them up with something, you can cause issues to happen, too. It might have been a timing issue where you watered them and took off too quick, or they just weren't used to it. So, but it wouldn't mean I wouldn't try it again.
And so what would be a good timing to hydrate them well before they run?
I usually water them before I do my hookup, so it's probably a half hour out. But they're on a regular schedule of doing that, so it's not a once-in-a-blue-moon thing. It's before every run they get it, so they get used to it. So I might see some of that happen early on, and then they kind of get used to the whole
situation. Do you do anything with their water to make it flavor better?
I might use kibble where I use hot water and kibble. I might bait the water before run. I never bait the water after. They just get straight water. And that's what works well for us.
Good idea.
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Well, thank you, Dr. Tim.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Tim, for that vet tip. That was wonderful. And I know it meant a lot for us to hear it. And I think we listened to it like 2 or 3 times before we even put it out here because we had to learn. And I'm sure other people probably needed it also. So this has been The Sled Dog, and we thank you so much. You can reach us at
www.sleddogpodcast.com.
And if you need to get a hold of us at all, you can email tim@sleddogpodcast.com or gina@sleddogpodcast.com. And again,
we love hearing your comments. We love getting direction from you. Sometimes it can't always follow through, but sometimes it does, and it's...
You didn't even act surprised. I changed our email addresses. So now we have tim@sleddogpodcast.com and Gina, and that's G-E-N-A,
@sleddogpodcast.com. You're a brilliant man.
Nah, stop. Okay, so that's how she gets me to quiet down. She just compliments me. Anyways, well, thank you, everybody. Hope you enjoyed the show. We enjoyed putting it out, and look for more coming real soon. Have a great day.
Be blessed, everyone.